you asked me, why did they come? They used to hear that the streets in America were paved with gold. But they never lost their love for the old country.
Saw that you've got to dress like the people here and speak like the people. You can go to church you want to. You can have what kind of food you want at home. You can dance a dub key. But you know, when you're out in public, you got to be seen as an American.
What Lebanese is to me, it really centers around my grandparents and what their values were and their faith and that sense of honor of being Lebanese.
It was to be expected. I mean, I knew I had to leave Lebanon eventually, whether it's for schooling or to make a living, you know. So it wasn't a big shock. The shock was the realization that you cannot go back to Lebanon anytime you want.
Living outside Lebanon for me is like taking a fish out of the water. Really, that's how I saw it. But I don't know, it seems like that fish have managed to survive for a long time outside the water.
Between 1880 and 1914, over 360,000 left Lebanon for the Americas. The great majority emigrated because of an economic crisis gripping the country. Global prices of silk, the source of livelihood for most Lebanese, had plummeted, leaving many teetering at the edge of poverty. So first in tens, then hundreds, and then by the thousands, Lebanese families boarded steamboats for America.
حمانة كانت ضيعة زراعية مثل ما قلت لك. الصناعة اللي فيها اللي كانت كتير مزدهرة، صناعة الحرير تلاشت. مشي اللي بلش يطلع مواد اصطناعية ما عاد الناس يطلبوا الحرير، وقفت صناعة الحرير، فصار في فراغ. هالفراغ ما تعبى دغري بشي تاني، يعني ما حدا خطر بباله يعمل صناعة جديدة غير شكل. هيدي سببت أول هجرة.
They wanted to find a better life, so they started roaming all over the world. My grandmother and her family went to South Africa, and then my dad's family moved to Argentina, then to Puerto Rico, and then to Mexico. And eventually, they went back to Lebanon, and my grandfather got married to my grandmother. And then right around 1907, they came to the United States of America.
Gutsy person he was, he leaves his wife and family of five children, not able to speak a word of English, comes to America, comes through Ellis Island. And how he made it, I don't know. But anyway, the clerk asked him his name and so forth, or registered him. And he says, my name is Hanna Mahul Fakhuri. Well, they knew Hanna was John. Got to Mahul, they put down M-A-C-K. And Fakhuri never got in the ball game at all. So we got named by a clerk at Ellis Island.
They ended up on the railroad, the Wilmington-Weldon Railroad, going to Wilmington to see someone about buying stock. It was their plan to sell stock as peddlers. And this railroad passed through Goldsboro, and it stopped in Goldsboro, and they got out, and they met people, and they liked what they saw, and they decided to come back here and to settle.
My father came to America and started a job that was harsh and hard, peddling with a bag of clothing and whatever else he could sell to people out in the rural areas.
They went door to door selling whatever peddlers sell, either cloth or thread or a certain amount of clothes or pots and pans, whatever it took. Then my father went back and came back with most of the family. This is prior to World War I. And they had made a little money. They bought a wagon, and they went around as peddlers on a wagon. And then eventually, my grandfather and his two sons, Charlie, my father, and Saeed, his older brother, they opened a department store in where I grew up, Mooresville, North Carolina, called John Mack & Sons.
When my grandparents were up in the Northeast, in Lowell, Mass, and Buffalo, they actually were working in mills, the steel mills and so forth. And then when they came down here, they transitioned into dry goods because my grandfather had his best friend lived in Greenville, J.R. Abby Eunice. And I guess the Abby Eunice family was into dry goods, and he kind of showed him the ropes there. But it was a very close community. You know, clearly the weddings, the church events and so forth, they were always gathering together for. But one of the more charming things is every Sunday, someone from a neighboring community would drop by the house. It was interesting to see how everybody shared all the news, both from the old country and from, you know, other parts of North Carolina.
Because my grandfather was a traveling salesman, he would travel from town to town, and he would stay in these homes. So he would bring news about what's going on in Kinston. How are the Ellises in Wilson? What's going on with them? So he was the link. And so this kind of brought people more to Goldsboro, brought people to my home. I mean, you could sit in my living room in Goldsboro on a Sunday afternoon, and there'd just be kind of a parade of people coming in to visit. And you would sit there as a young boy and just hear those stories. And you'd have to kind of look through the cigar smoke. And then when you went to church within the Goldsboro community, I mean, you saw the same people.
Religion was a very, very important thing to the Lebanese people, and kept the Catholic Church going. Now has St. Michael's Maronite Church in Fayetteville, and St. Charbel Mission here in Raleigh, so we've come a long, long way. You know, remember the times, gosh, Sacred Heart Cathedral here in Raleigh, which is not a big, big church, but You never saw it filled, except two times a year, at Easter and in midnight mass at Christmas.
Their religion was very important to them. Their food, they loved Lebanese food. But I think those, and family, those were the three things they really held on to. But they adapted very quickly into speaking English and wearing American clothing and really wanted to blend in and become part of America.
The mountains of Lebanon provided a safe haven for Muslim and Christian religious sects for many centuries. By the end of the 1800s, over half of Lebanon's population were Christians, primarily Catholics. It was mainly these Catholics who left their homes for America. In Lebanon, identity centered on family, village, and religion. Race was not a category that held any meaning. Yet when Lebanese immigrants arrived in North Carolina, they entered the world that was mapped by race. The early immigrants' encounter with racial politics and divides varied. Many experienced discrimination and ridicule as darker-skinned foreigners.
We were the only Catholics in town of 1,000 people. And we were looked up on, we were looked down on, because we were Catholics and Lebanese both.
There were definitely three different classes of people. And three were not, that I've very experienced with, was not what you want to be. Number one was a foreigner. That's a no-no. And again, very few people had opportunities to engage with someone from another culture. The other was a Catholic, and the other was black. So of the three worst things that you could be, I'm two out of three. And that's not a bad batting average.
There were a few people that made disparaging remarks. We used to be called unattractive names, you know. We had a few people to do that, but after a few fights, our family convinced us that we shouldn't fight back. Just forget, you know, just consider the source and not fight back.
Mooresville, North Carolina, when I grew up, was 3,000 to 4,000 people. It was a mill town. If you didn't work at the mill, you were odd in the first place. Everyone worked at the mill. And the traditional mill housing, all cookie cutter, white, two bedroom wooden structures spread out around the mills. So, you know, we're very different. Most people were Baptist, some were Presbyterian. And you know, we were dark, we were Catholics. We were a little bit of an oddity, there's no question about that.
I think that there was still a intense sense of unity and pride because you wanted to at least go to a town, albeit small, where there's maybe other Lebanese people involved. So I think there was that little community of a few, and that was enough probably to sustain you despite everything. You know, with success comes a lot of acceptance. And I think if you're a successful business person, you become accepted.
My mother's parents had six children, and they had a store. and it was three blocks from the house, and they would walk back and forth to the store, and she was able to take care of the children and spend time in the store. And she was, you know, a lot of times she would do the seamstress work in the store, you know, as well as, you know, working with the people. And then when you got old enough, you ended up in the store. So the children worked in the store. You know, I know we did, and I know our parents did too. So that was kind of where you learned.
As soon as we were old enough to touch the cash register, we had to go to work in the store. We were there when the war broke out, you know. So my mother was very generous to the soldiers. They would come, and actually they would give her their money to hold because they knew they might get drunk or some girl would take it away from them, whatever. But she held their money, and there were so many Catholic soldiers that they had to have mass in the public theater, and there was no place else to eat. So my father had to open his restaurant on Sunday to feed the people who had to eat.
Some of the older men did not like the women working, and I remember them talking about that. That was something of a, you know, a little bit of a scandal, a woman who didn't stay home with her children. And of course, my Aunt Hannah ended up staying home with her two children and helping raise the other kids.
My mother and dad were, they were always working. They were tough times, and you didn't know any better. The people around us worked at Pilot Cotton Mill. A couple of guys worked for the railroad. One guy had a little neighborhood grocery store. My dad had one, but his was on the other side of town. I got my first bicycle, had to have a basket on it so that after school I would go down to the store and make two or three deliveries, whatever he had ready. Then after that, I'd ride my bicycle back to the other side of town, go home and get my homework done.
At least in our family, and I don't think it was unlike a lot of immigrant families from Lebanon, it was about family first. It was about religion next, and we were Catholics. And it was about, you know, the work ethic, education next. So that was always drummed into us.
The sense of family was so dominant, but very close to it was the sense of education. It was, okay, my grandparents, I don't know how they were formally educated. And I don't know that they instilled this concept in my parents, but these Sunday afternoons, wherever you're having these conversations, it was about how do you better yourself. You don't start anyway. You can be successful in business, or you can do what. And they supported each other in business. But this idea of education was, this is the way that you live this American dream.
My dad's generation were the old people who were the ones who came from Lebanon. And of course, many of them continued to speak Arabic or spoke in halting English. My dad's generation were completely English speaking because they were not allowed to speak Arabic. They, you know, they could say Aina, hey Aina, or Tini Gibbet Mwai. They give me some water. There were a few little endearing expressions and things, but they pushed them very hard to learn to speak and write in English. And so, sadly, I guess in a way, but in a way it was a good thing, they became prolific English speakers. My father became a lawyer, they became successful business people, and obviously in this country, the key to that is being able to speak English.
We all had friends, and I think we were able to, you know, assimilate within most of the things. But I think, you know, it's probably our parents that kept us more attuned to, you know, your background and heritage. The traditions of Lebanon were very strong. I mean, there was probably wasn't a day went by we didn't have some of the food. I mean, I think Patricia said it. You know, you sit around and you share food, you share culture.
There was nothing to see 50 people sitting at a table eating on Sunday afternoon. Nothing. I mean, Grandmama had a table that was, 30 feet long? And it was full. I don't know how those women did it. Because when I cook now, any Lebanese dish, especially kibbe, it's a very difficult thing to make. Those ladies worked hard.
My Aunt Lucille and my mother every spring would go to some farmer and buy a calf or a couple lambs and fatten them up, and then butcher or the slaughterhouse would deliver half of a cow, half of a lamb, and they would spend all day in the kitchen cutting that up into parcels. You know, this is for gibbonai, and this is for stew, and that's for making mishui, whatever it was they did. And then they froze it and brought it out. So they're very focused on feeding their family.
I wish I could remember his name. He used to make calls at the Lebanese homes and where we could order our food, the Lebanese food, and from New York, and it would be shipped. He'd come make an annual twice a year visit. We'd order the burger and whatever else that we needed. That time they didn't have many stores in this area.
A lot of things they had to improvise, you know, because they couldn't get lamb. But there just wasn't good source of lamb in the South, in the United States. And so they switched to ground beef in a lot of the kibbeh recipes and the other things like that. And I can remember Mother Rosa sending me to the local grocery down the corner. And she'd always tell me to get a ham, slice off a slice of sirloin, run it through the meat grinder, put that aside. That was just to clean the meat grinder at the grocery store. And then get a round steak and trim it, all the fat off of it, nothing on it, no fat, nothing, trim as it could be, and run that through. And then after you got it run through, run it through again to make it tastier for the kibbeh. And then bring it straight home so she could get it ready right away while it was fresh.
My kids would have their grandfather come speak to the class. And I remember his idea was to make meat pies. Well, not only did we make meat pies for the class, there were 4 fifth grade classes. So we made meat pies for how many kids was it? 120
over 100
kids.
People, yeah.
So I did biscuits, which my grandmother would roll over in her grave if she knew I was using cans of biscuits for Toya. But I made the hashwi, you know, but I didn't do pine nuts. I was being cheap for 120 kids, and they each rolled out their own meat pies.
There was a company in New York that produced an Arabic newspaper. They subscribed to it, and they combed it. You know, each issue that came in, and it was all in Arabic, so I really don't know what it said. I wish I had learned the second language. At the time, I really couldn't be bothered with it. As a kid, I was trying hard to assimilate with the other Anglo-Saxons world that we lived in.
My mother and father understood Arabic more than they could speak Arabic. But my grandmother got a newspaper. Oh, she read that newspaper religiously.
We didn't speak Arabic at home except my grandmother. Sometimes I'd hear her talking to my mother or something like that. But by living in Durham, Roxbury, and Mebane and all that stuff, we were away from the Arabic people. There was no Arabic people there. The only time I got back in touch with the Arabic people was in 1932 when we moved to Newport.
All the young people in those places from Newbern coming up this way to Raleigh formed an organization, the Lebanese group, and we used to have what is known as hafli.
I would probably remember going to maybe a half a dozen growing up where they would, all the Lebanese for certain areas of the state would eat together. Traditionally, living in South Carolina, we would go to Columbia.